Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thung, Earthlets, and welcome to a new episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. Apologies for our silence, our absence over the last few weeks, a combination of a few things. I went on holiday and then I got locked out of the account and then I got sick. So kind of a perfect storm that has kept us out of your ears over the past month or so. So apologies for that, but we are back now. I guess it's perfect time as any to talk about the future for the Thrillcast. I'm going to bring the lockdown tapes, as they were known, to an end. Incredible run of, knocking on 18 months of weekly episodes. Feedback on those was fantastic. Thank you so much, everyone who's really enjoyed those. We're going to go back to a fortnightly schedule, just because although the world isn't necessarily... There's still a pandemic on. It's not necessarily getting back to normal. Lots of things are starting to open up. Lots of things, particularly bookstores, comic book stores, etc. So there's demands on my time, which means a weekly episode just isn't practical for me anymore. So apologies for that. However, we are going to be bringing you new episodes every 2 weeks. So looking forward to returning to normal, at least on this podcast. So I hope in the interim you've all been keeping well and been enjoying all the delights of the galaxy's greatest comic. I mean, there's been so much happening over the last few weeks. It's been quite mad. So check out the new subscriber incentives that we've got when you should subscribe to 2000 AD and the Judge Dredd magazine. There's a AD 2000, which was the dummy that IPC saw back in 1976 to green light Juvenile Paper 13, I think 2000 AD was called at the time. We've reproduced the original dummy with, unlettered artwork, the original lineup, the original cover, which is very different to the one that ended up being on the first prog. You get that if you take out a print subscription to 2000 AD or the magazine. If you take out a combi subscription to both, then you also get a Dave Gibbons print. Now, this was a poster that was given away with progs 200 to 205 back in 1983, I think. You would cut it out and stick it all together and put it up on your wall. But there's no need to massacre all progs anymore. You can now get this print when you take out a combi subscription. All subscribers, both print and digital, get a 50% off voucher. Digital subscribers get free back issues, plus they can access both the web shop and the app. So go along to the website and check those out. We've also started a new series of critical essays by some leading comic critics. We've had ones on Megatropolis. We've got ones coming up on Dead World, 13th Floor. Really interesting seeing people delve into current collections, future collections. If you enjoy the deep dives that we did during the lockdown tapes, then you definitely enjoy those as well. So keep your eye out for those. This episode, we're going to be chatting with Kelvin Gosnell. Now, Kelvin, we talked to a number of years ago about his time as editor of 2000 AD, but also a writer. He worked on the adaptation of Harry Harrison's Stainless Steel Rat, which was drawn spectacularly well by Carlos Esquerda. So because we brought out a new collection in the summer of the Stainless Steel Rat comic books, I thought it'd be an ideal time just to get him on the line, just chatting in hopefully a little bit more depth about that adaptation. And I was very delighted to be joined by John Freeman, who's the editor of Down the Tubes, Who has a bit more knowledge about comics editing and that period of comics editing than I have. So it was a three-hander for this interview. So we'll crack on with that now. It was wonderful to be able to reconnect with Kelvin after the huge interview we did a number of years ago. Go and check it out if you haven't. But it was great to be able to sit down and chat to him again about Stainless Steel Rat. Thank you, first and foremost, to you, Kelvin, for agreeing to do this, and also to John for agreeing to help me talk to Kelvin.
I hope so.
Because we did a nice long interview a few years ago when I came down to the South Coast, but I figured because the deluxe edition of the Stainless Steel Rat, there we go, is out now, that it would be a nice time to revisit that chat, but also just kind of explore the Stainless Steel Rat a little bit more than we did at the time. I guess the obvious place to start is just to hear from you, Kelvin, how this adaptation came about, because 2000 AD has done the odd adaptation, but this is by far the most successful one. How did you come to be adapting?
Something that I had in mind from the very beginning. If I can just ask me 2 seconds. The little bit of paper that we were talking about, the memo that started it all, actually had it on there.
Right.
It's nice. It's got a bit wonky over the years, but I quote, "It might even be possible to obtain serialization rights to material from some of the established authors, Clark Bradbury, for example, that could work suitably for the younger reader." It's all in there. So it was something I had in mind right from the very beginning. It was, I don't think the others were that keen on the idea, in that they wanted 2008 to be its own thing and not take from anyone else. I thought that was wrong, but I just went along with it at the time. But then when Bartholomew took over, I still had the idea of using someone at the back of my head. And I happened to mention Harry Harrison. And Bob Bart had worked on Eagle and Swift, which Harry had actually written for. I think he wrote a thing called the Lost Platoon or Time Patrol. That was it. Bart knew Harry and said he'll get in touch and see what he thought about it, you know. And luckily, H still knew Bart very well. And it was all set up through him. I don't think Sanders was particularly keen on the idea, but because, again, it was rights and royalties, you know, they were dead set terribly. But we got in touch with Harry, so he thought it'd be a great idea with these wonderful, long, interminable meetings, because he was a great Anglophile, loved the whole English thing, lived in Southern Ireland, you know. We used to meet in this old Englishy gentleman's clubby that Harry was a member of, having things like Steak and Kidney Pud and things like that. We discussed it all there. And, of course, he had a history in comic strips anyway. He thought it was a great idea. So I've always thought that The Rat, playing the Steel Rat, a great story to adapt to both picture strip and film, for that matter. Strangely, it's never been done. Been auctioned thousands of times, so Harry told us, but never got made into a film, sadly. That's where it came from. I'd always wanted to do it, and H thought it was a good idea, so we went ahead. And then, holy of holies, I discovered that Carlos was a great fan, and I won't say he begged me to do it, but he really, really wanted to do it, because like me, he'd read them all 2 or 3 times, and that's where it came from. But was it really successful then, when it was reprinted?
I mean, it's this edition has certainly done very, very well. So the special hardcover that we did has sold out twice, and the paperback's doing very well as well. So
I'm really pleased to hear that, because you know you get out of touch with things. As you know, I moved out of point to all sorts of other bits of journalism and didn't follow what was happening. And I did sometimes wonder that doing The Rat was just a big self-indulgence on the part of me and Carlos, that it wasn't actually a successful thing for 2000. But it's good to hear that it did actually go well. I still have done it, so I love it.
Well, I think you've got to have self-belief in yourself as an editor, haven't you? To decide, I'm going to try this and see whether it works or not. I'm sure even then, readers gave you feedback on whether they enjoyed the strip.
Well, when I was writing the rap, I wasn't actually working on 2000 gig. Mm. I moved off in another direction when we actually started it. I think it's true to say that certainly on the second and third one, but not sure about the first. And you never, very difficult editorially to get feedback in the whole IPC situation. And other than occasional letters, which were very good in the early part, we very rarely saw a great deal of feedback coming through. So you just cross your fingers and hope, you know.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in what you mentioned there about the resistance to doing an adaptation of The Rat, because when you typed up your famous memo saying that it'd be a good idea to cash in on the boom in science fiction that was happening in cinema, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think even Pat was reluctant about the idea, because to him, sci-fi meant Little Green Men and, you know, Dan Dare and all this, that and the other. A version of Dan Dare, certainly.
There was a resistance to sci-fi because some of the people in the business, in the comic strip business, who were into science fiction, how can I put this? But I can't put it politely. They were so up themselves, telling us that you shouldn't talk about SF. It was sci-fi, and it should be hyphenated with a cap F, isn't it? So what? It's science fiction. It's stuff that hasn't happened yet. It might have something to do with spaceships. It's good fun, but to go on into that sort of anal depth about the whole thing—that was one of the things that put Pat off, and me as well as a science fiction reader put me off. But they were worried that the sci-fi, as I saw it, and I did, and as I saw it as a written thing, because the big films hadn't started to come out then, was too establishment, if you like. And then there was, of course, Sanders was worried about the rights and royalties side of it. I suppose The Rat was the first time we moved into previously published establishment science fiction.
Mm. That might seem strange now because in modern comics, people, a publisher would think nothing about licensing an author's fiction, like Titan, for example, was done with Lost Fleet and numerous other projects, or as much as it would license Star Wars or Transformers or any other licensed property. But now, but back then, you were cutting new ground, really.
Well, I think the reason that they do that now, it sounds a bit big-headed, but it's because of what 2000 AD did. It made the artists, the writer, the creators, it gave them their head and let them do what they wanted to do, so that they then became established authors in their own right and accepted as established authors in their own right. Not just, as I quote somebody from the past, you know, the people that write the bubbles, which is a pretty bad word of mechanics. But I think 2000, particularly in the spin-offs of stuff like Happy, into the terms of the graphic novels, for example, and people like Gaiman have picked up on that, and they've become big names in their own right, and therefore publishers are going to snap along. This is good.
Once you got the rights to adapt it, what was your process for adapting them as a fan? I mean, this is a question that I put a shout out on Twitter for questions. This was one of the ones that came through. Of course, there's multiple stainless steel rat books. What made you decide to adapt the ones that you did?
Well, I think at the time there weren't that many. I think there were only three or four. There was Stanley Steel Rat, then Saves the World, and then For President. I think there were a couple that followed on afterwards, but we did those three because they were the first three, and they're the three that I enjoyed the most. Anyway, what was the process, really? Go back, read them again. I mean, I'd already read them about two or three times each anyway. They were on my repeat read list, you know, along with City of the Stars by Clark and Technicolor Time Machine, again, by Harrison. There's one that should be done. Technicolor Time Machine by Harry Harrison. Fantastic for a strip. Anyway, I would read over the books again and then get a rough idea of how each 4, 5, or whatever page episode would, or how much book I could fit into each episode, work out what length I want the thing to run to, whether it's going to be 10, 12, or whatever, bearing in mind what the schedules were going to be for Harry to read stuff for Carlos to draw it and then get it all produced. And then I would sit down and say, well, I've got chapters 1, 2, and 3 that are going to be the first episode. Then you look at the visuals of each one and decide how many frames you're going to have and work it from then. It just becomes writing script. So each book was looked at like that, you know, broke down into number of chapters or how many chapters per strip episode. Then look for the visuals in there, work out, and then do the whole film director thing, that's what's going to be big, what's going to be small. And when it came to writing dialogue, you hardly have to rewrite any, because Harry just writes such cool, clean, crisp dialogue.
Harry Harrison's on record as asking you to cut some of the dialogue from the scripts.
Was he?
Yeah, he claimed that he told you to cut some of the dialogue back and stick and concentrate on the action, which is interesting. Perhaps because of his background doing the strips, the earlier strips that he did.
It could be. Yeah, to be honest, I don't remember him saying that. He probably did, but this is maybe.
Yeah, exactly. It's like when people ask me, "Well,
we had lots of fun meetings, which often disappeared into a brandy bottle somewhere." So I'm not afraid of it. But if you did, I probably did as well. You know, that's one of the points of writing about script is to be able to cut down, almost do a newspaper sub, job for news on it. Not a features editor, a news editor. Get it right down to the basics, and then go back over it again to make sure it's entertaining to read, as well as getting the information across. You do have to study it down pretty hard.
Yeah, I still work to the, you know, if I'm writing something, I still work to that word count in Word Balloons, no more than 25 at the very most. You know, sort of that.
Yeah, but be prepared to throw it out sometimes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's why I quite like seeing the artwork when it comes in, and you can cut the dialogue back again because you know, an artist like Carlos Esquerra has told the story in visually, so you don't need the word balloons necessarily.
Yeah. Unless you're working again with the words, you know, like the Carlos thing behind me, the spread of the waterworks from the Strontium Gold thing, where John Wagner works in as a Gershwin musical, as a bright note, the song, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. And the whole spread is about singing that song. So occasionally you have to let the words take over. But even then, Carlos does a great job, you know.
I wanted to ask about Carlos because his work on this, by the time Senny Steel Rat came around, he's kind of at the height of his powers. You know, this is the period that where we're leading up to his return to Judge Dredd and the Apocalypse War and strips like that. He was a busy guy.
Yeah.
But as you say, he was a Harrison fan. So was it a case of, oh, absolutely, I'm gonna do this regardless, or was there a bit of kind of negotiation that had to take place?
I think of it as the former. I never had to persuade him to do it, because he so desperately wanted to do it. He loved the character. He liked all the guy's writing. And that's, again, as I say, that's how I remember it. Carlos wanted to do it. It got done. I think it may have caused a little bit of friction. Is that the right word? Probably not. With other writers, because they felt their stuff, like, say, The Judge or something else, should have been done by Carlos while he was fiddling about with this stuff that they didn't think ought to be in the script. There may have been some friction there caused by that. I certainly thought there was at the time, but Carlos wanted to do it, I wanted to do it, and it was felt a good thing to do, so it got done.
When you started working on Stainless Steel Rat, the first strip,
yeah,
were you aware you were already, did you had already have the rights to do the other two books, or was it just going to be a bait, or did they sort of like hedge their bets?
To be honest, John, I don't know. Right. Because that would have been dealt with on the Bob Bartholomew and John Sanders level, together right. with the IPC lawyer, who was curiously known as Perry Mason, believe it or not. He really was Peter Mason. And Sanders always referred to me as Perry Mason. And that was all done at their level. And you never got to hear anything like that. Even if you asked, you weren't told. You never got an answer.
Yeah.
So they may have opted, taking an option on all the books. Or it might have just been a free and easy gentleman's agreement, which is the sort of thing that Harry would do. You know, you can have the answer if you want. You know, as long as you got paid when it was sorted out, then you should get paid in money.
Okay.
And in terms of the process of producing that first series, were you still producing scripts as Carlos was drawing them?
After a fashion, yeah, I tried to be always at least three scripts ahead of what I needed to be. I did not want to get to the situation where you had to hold over the publication because it had been late coming in. I've been trying to do that in 2018 from the very beginning because I felt, as do others, that it was important to have one artist, the same artist, write a drawing, the same thing all the way through. And I really wanted that to happen with the rat because I could see eventually it would start to be things like the collected books, which Rebellion had just done. It's something I had in mind to do all the way through. But again, persuading the management that's a good idea was just not going to work. But no, I'm always trying to be at least three scripts, if not more, ahead. I'd like to have been able to have the whole. They tended to work out about 12 episodes, didn't they? Had the whole 12, script for the whole 12 ready. Get six of them in before you start to publish. Whereas it was virtually hand to mouth, week by week, for most of the other ones.
Bloody nightmare
sometimes.
Yeah. I'm interested in how, therefore, you may have been affected in your writing by how Carlos was handling those early episodes. Were you in any way seeing those early episodes and go, wow, Carlos is pulling out all the stops. I should do that too, or was it exactly what you were hoping for?
Well, you always knew that Carlos would pull out all the stops. You always did. It was always absolutely perfect for the story. I remember when he brought in the artwork. Sometimes he was working over here rather than in Spain or whatever the other place. He brought in the set with the first appearance of Mrs. Jim, Angelina.
Angelina?
Is that Angelina? Yeah. I'm thinking of a song with the name. And he just sort of brought her out and said, what do you think of that? Oh, shit. It was just perfect. And there's so much of it that sums it all up. Whatever you did, you know that, particularly with the rat, which is something close to his heart and he liked, that you knew it was going to be right and better than right, you know. So, I suppose I did try to make it the very best I've done. It certainly became the most enjoyable stuff that I've ever done. And I really love doing it.
It seems quite obvious that Carlos did, especially when he draws himself in as Slippery Jim DeGrees towards the end of the story. That great moustache of his.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we both enjoyed it enormously. It was jolly great fun. Just had a great time doing it.
One thing that's really striking is the Carlos was clearly taken with James Coburn. Because obviously you've got Major Easy from Battle, and then you've got the stainless steel rat.
I don't know what you mean. Everybody's got a face they draw, and he didn't. I'm sure that maybe for Major Easy, he may have taken Coburn as a sort of app. But when you look at other artists, the same thing tends to happen. You look at Ian Kennedy's work, you can tell Ian Kennedy's work from a simple look straight away at the face that it's Ian, because he does something about the eyes that are unique to his style. And the faces as well tend to get a certain shape. And I think Carlos just happened to draw a Major Easy type face. Sorry, a Jimmy Coburn face. I don't think anyone actually said, go and make it James Coburn.
Well, like
they said with Bill Savage, they said, go and make it Stanley Baker, which Jesus Buster did very well.
That was going to be my next question, whether it was a conscious choice to say, you know, make him look like James Coburn. Because one of the questions that we got online from a friend of mine, Mike Donaghy, it's not from him, it's from somebody else. It was whether the way that Carlos drew Angelina was based on Servalan from Blake 7. You know, the kind of bob haircut and all this, that, and the other. And again, I just didn't know whether that was a conscious choice or whether it had been something that you discussed with him.
I think I'd have been born deeply in love with Angelina if I thought that, because I'd met the actress, Jackie Pierce, who played Servalan, because I did a magazine to do with Blake. And she was what a gentleman would call not unattractive, and really very charming. In that when you met her, you went, whoa. And I think Carlos made her, had the same effect with Angelina, yeah. I was not aware of that at the time, and I think I would have been.
Yeah, where would Carlos have even seen Blake 7? I mean, was he in the UK?
Sometimes he was working on living over here.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know what period. You know, I knew where he was.
I think he moved to Croydon in 72.
Right.
Oh, no, wait. Not 72. Later than that. Because he moved... See, this is where my brain plays tricks on me. Because he moved because of all the work he was getting from IPC. Maybe it was Battle. Maybe it was later than that. Maybe it was 76 that he moved. 75, 76.
Yeah, that would have been about the time that 2000 started to ramp up. Yeah, so perhaps he was here then, but I know that certain periods he was working in Spain. But exactly when and where, I really don't say.
I have to toddle off and find that now, so yeah, keep talking.
You're going to toddle off and find, sorry, Mark. Other times... When he was working here?
Yeah, I know I've written it down somewhere. I'll be back in 2 seconds.
Okay. Right. I don't know if he's going to... John, I must ask you.
Yeah.
I looked you up on Google or one of the things like that. I think it might be in Wiki. You are pictured standing in front of a Red Arrow sport.
That was when I was actually editing RAF magazine for Titan. They in their infinite wisdom, Titan decided to do an RAF magazine, which proved to be an interesting experience, shall we say. But I did have the benefit of getting down to the air shows with my friend Tim Ripley, who's a military journalist who writes for The Times and The Telegraph. And one of my other hats, I do his website for him. So We were treated to a lunch in the BAA Systems tent, which was, I have to say, was an amazing experience. You know, an eye opening in terms of what.
which gig was that? Which show? Was it one of the big shows?
Yeah, the one, oh gosh, you know, Ian, talk about memories, but that it was down towards the south, the really big one. That's
IAT, the International Institute, Green and Common. Well, it used to be Green and Common, but then became Stairford.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one. Yeah.
Probably what I went to was, I guess, a Blocky. So I used to work for James, you know, the James Defence Weekly and all that. And we got drafted.
Tim wrote for James as well. He's written very well. Yeah.
You're an ethics modeler. Did you ever come across the ethics modeler's club in Valiant?
Yeah, how on earth did Dick Emery become the president of the Airfix Modelers Club?
He didn't. I was him.
So you...
He became the president of the Airfix Modelers Club because he had a heart attack. And,
right.
The only way they could keep him to sit still was to give him Airfix models to make. And
right.
The president of Airfix, I forget his name now, he got to hear of this. And then he came to IBC and said, let's start an Airfix Modelers Club in whatever community you want. They said Valiant. Let's have Dick Emery as the president thereof. And he did it. All he did was a couple of photo shoots with a couple of headshots. And it was down to Muggins the sub every week. Hello, chums. You know, it was good fun, though. Again, I got some interesting gigs out of it. Era Battington tied them off. And all sorts of other stuff as well. But that was great fun doing that. Getting paid, I didn't actually get paid until it moved to Battle, which is a different comic. But it was great fun doing that.
I'm sorry to interrupt on this.
That's an exclusive. That is. I'm going to tell. My down the tubes contributor Jeremy Briggs, who is very engaged with Constant Modeler, the Airfix magazine, will be delighted to hear that Colwyn Gosnell is really Dick Emery.
I wrote that for like 2 years, I think, on Battle. I wrote all of it, all the way through, for as long as it lasted. I was always the president, even when Emery left and it. The Airfix went broke, didn't they? And it became some other outfit, French one. I was doing that all the way through 2008 as well, because it was a little bit of freelance that you did on the side, and you couldn't stop, you know. It was you felt obliged.
But Carlos moved to Britain in 1974.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah, because he was
the year before I did the memo, so just notice that it's 1975. So he would have been here in, how long was he here from 74 to when? You got to move it up again. No.
You got me there. I don't exactly, I think it was sometime in the early 80s that he went back.
All right, that definitely covers the whole of Blake 7 being on telly.
Yeah.
Along with the other along with Jerry Anderson shows as well, his live action stuff. And that's
That's a shame about Blake. It's been quite well. And then we just got a call that Stuart Wales was by doing the. Sorry, we digress a little bit, but it is quite fun. Stuart Wales, who is the previous editor of Longhead, I think, we were both freelance at the time, and we were both doing this magazine for the whole Blake thing. And we just got a call on 7 o'clock on Saturday evening. They're closing the show. Come to the wake. It's at the BBC TV Centre. Be there now. We just climbed in a car and went over and had the most amazing time. Sadly, Jackie Guess wasn't there. But they've got something you'll never see, which their bloopers reel is untransmittable. If this is not recording, I can tell you something later. But not
okay.
Let's get back to comics. Sorry, Mike. Go ahead.
Yes.
With the stainless steel rat, you mentioned that you didn't really get an awful lot of feedback. So was this more of a case of I'll just keep doing it until somebody tells me to stop?
That's a very good question. I can't really answer it in any great depth. Certainly, the first two I felt we were committed to and had to do. The third, possibly not, but it got done anyway. But no, I don't think so. It was just, it was something that I was doing and it got done. That may sound a bit vacuous and vague, but when you're dealing with fiction, things get like that. You know, the stories kind of take you over. One of the reasons I buy out writing fiction, because it does really a bit. They just got done. That's it.
Because I wanted to explore a little bit about your thoughts on the character himself and the evolution he goes through, the world he inhabits. Because I commissioned a piece for the 2080 website. They talk a lot about the role of authority in the Stainless Steel Rat and how that's reflected in Harry Harrison's own experience dealing with various authority figures. So I wanted to get your feelings on the story of the Stainless Steel Rat. You know, him as a character, what are the elements that appeal to you? And does that grow stronger as he goes through the process of, you know, getting recruited by the authorities and having his story change so radically?
I see what you mean. I don't think he wrote it at that depth. That element was certainly there, is in there with actually everything that Harry did. We've got the one I mentioned earlier, the soldier one, name's gone. Bill the Galactic Hero. You look at that, and that's kind of the same story running through it. But I say, I don't think Harry set out to write didactically at that level. But his character came through like that. And the closest story to it, I suppose, in popular fiction was probably that, is it a Cary Grant film, To Catch a Thief?
Yeah.
It might have been Cary Grant, I'm not sure. Could have been Bob Wagner or someone like that. This is, you know, the best person to catch a thief is a thief himself. And that was a film in the 50s, I think. And it was probably done much earlier than that as well. Jim DeGriz is very similar. I wouldn't say based on, but it's a standard kind of story. The bad guy gets caught out and turns into a good guy. And again, I said, I don't think Harry wrote at that level. I certainly didn't think at that level. Jim DeGriz was just a most entertaining, very brave and courageous and amusing man to be with.
Because the reason I ask is, as Ritesh points out, Harrison was a military policeman in the Second World War, I believe. And that kind of...
I knew he was in Houston. He was in the United States Air Force. But I never knew he was a cop over there. I thought he was... I thought he wanted to be air crew, couldn't make it, and ended up in engineering. But I'm really surprised by that. I wouldn't have thought Harry would have done go along with that. And maybe he could work the rules from within, you know.
Well, quoting from the article... he was drafted into the US Army Air Forces in the 40s and he bloody hated it. He was dreadfully bored, but beyond that, he came to utterly loathe the military. But nevertheless, that doesn't mean he could divorce himself from his own history, his own militarist past of being a military policeman. And that's reflected in Jim DeGriz with an anti-authority figure forced to become a figure of said authority. Is that an element that appeals to you about that character?
Now you mention it, having discovered that H was a military policeman, then that makes things fall into place a lot more. I'm going to have to go back and read the same Bill the Galactic Hero again. Probably read it three times, but because there's a character in there called Death Wish Drank. Have you read it? Do you know the story? You must read it.
I've read the novels, but not Bill the Galactic Hero, unfortunately.
Oh, do so. It is wonderful. Bill the Galactic Hero and the other one, Ten Colour Time Machine. Absolutely classic science fiction. And
yeah, no sense. That's a cracker.
Yeah, but you've been quite strict, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, it would. But I think in Bill the Galactic Hero, there is this sergeant character who does all the recruiting, who is the archetypal military man. And he's called Death Wish because he's had implanted into his face two huge tusks that come up like this that he uses to terrify recruits and make them join. Don't ask me. Typical Harry. You know, the major recruiting officer goes around terrifying people to make them join up. And now you tell me Harry used to be a military cop, then it all starts to make sense. Yeah.
You mentioned To Catch a Thief. The other thing that there's a sort of echo of Our Man Flint, the two spy films from the 1960s in the character as well, perhaps. Yeah. You know, where Our Man Flint's not quite the same type of character, but there's that kind of feel to him. And certainly the actor, you know, there's that. I got that impression. I was wondering, in terms of, you know, you push this idea of adapting science fiction for 2000 AD with a strong character like Our Man Flint. A character like the Stainless Steel Rat. Were there other characters that you looked at from science fiction that you were also considering at the time to try this idea out?
Not really, because Slippery Jim was the character to do it with. None of the others had all the elements that you need, the action, the fun, the humour, and the really good stories and visuals, all mixed together. You can look at, my favourite stories, two of my favourite science fiction stories are The City of the Stars by Arthur Clarke, and that's got the visuals and half a character. The other one, The End of Eternity by Asimov, that's got a fantastic plot, but the characters are rather flat. You could go on and on and on, running all the way through various bits of science fiction and or fantasy, and you wouldn't find anything as integrated and perfectly made for strip work as you would with degrees.
And certainly for 2000 AD, which its strength has always been its strong characters, either male or female, and that's why, to my mind, that's the success of 2000 AD, and Stainless Steel Rat fitted perfectly into that.
Yeah, I mean, when quoting from the original memo earlier, that, you know, that there would be some Clark that we could maybe do or some Asim, that was wrong. That wouldn't have worked. You might have got future shocks out for a couple of them in short stories, but both of them, they racist work. I think, like with Clark, was The City and the Stars. And it is one of the greatest works of science fiction ever done, but it is unfilmable. They bought options on it over and over again. They can't do it because it doesn't lend itself visually to making most directors feel it doesn't. I still think it could, but it would probably be one of those things that cost $10 billion and be a complete box office flop.
It's curious to me that Stainless Steel Rat made it into comics thanks to your work and Carlos's, but hasn't made it to the big screen, although it has, as you say, been optioned. I mean, I think Jan de Bont was attached at one time as director to a Stainless Steel Rat project. And, of course, Alex Cox did manage to bring Bill the Galactic Hero to the big screen as a sort of largest student film, which he funded through crowdfunding. But it's curious that he hasn't made it.
No, Harry was very laid back, if not cynical, about the whole thing. He said he regarded the optioning of Slippery Jim, that Stainless Steel Rat, for a movie, the constant buying of options to make the film, as a separate revenue stream. They would pay for the rights, and then they'd hold endless meetings and studies, and their mates would earn lots of money doing studies about this, that, the other, and they'd have more meetings, and they wouldn't get made. But he'd still get his optioning fee. So he said he thought it was a separate revenue stream, you know. I said there was a certain cynicism about that, because he knew, like us, that Jim was a great character that worked brilliantly, as I now learn, in pitch strip, and would work fantastically in film. But especially now, it'd be so desperately easy to make. But it never did. I'm surprised, aren't you? It should have been.
Have you ever thought about adapting the other stories? Pitching, was there ever a time that you thought, actually, shall I go back and do the others with 2000 AD?
No, because when I moved away from fiction, and for fiction, really, fiction in general, I just wanted away from it. It was, as I said, put it, to use a technical term, it was doing me in. Fiction is very hard on it. It does, it gets to your character and it can be very hard, and it wasn't right for me, so I moved up into general, different types of journalism. The only thing that does do that is something that John might have something to say about. I really do think that Bandera has been redone properly and should be thought about being done properly now. But that's the only thing that might get me to think about writing fiction again. But no, I wouldn't. Even for Slippery Jim, I think it's like 40 Towers. He knew when he'd done enough and he stopped. And I think Jim at 3 is enough. Stop. But Dan Dare, that's a different matter.
Well, we could be here all day talking about whether you can revive Dan Dare. I mean, 2000 AD, he's tried it. I've done it. It can work. Unfortunately, the core audience for Dan Dare is increasingly of an older generation, and we haven't been able to grab a younger audience to introduce them to the character. Unfortunately, which is sad.
Yeah, we talk about that. We're crowding it up to something else. There's angles that haven't been thought of, I'm sure. And could be done. So another time, perhaps. Yeah, we must talk.
One of the questions that came to on Twitter from Alan Harvey was, as Harry Harrison used to be a comic artist back in the 1950s, was there any thought given to perhaps, you know, him doing a guest cover or a pin-up to go alongside the strip?
No, because to be absolutely honest, I don't think any of us knew that he was an artist. We knew him as a writer, which is what he did for the British comics like Swift and possibly Eagle, I'm not sure, but certainly Swift. And of course, being so well known as a novelist, I didn't know until you just told me that he used to draw as well. I can see how he would now you mention it, but and he never mentioned it either when we met. You know, if we'd known, then certainly we would have asked him just for the fun of it, because we know that whatever you get, it would be fun. It would be good. What did he draw then? You tell.
I'm just checking.
We're going to talk about airplanes again while you check.
Yes, the whole RAF magazine project came from outside the RAF. In fact, it was the licensing agent for the RAF who wanted to do the magazine.
Yeah, but I think Titan did it.
Yeah, well, I think that Terry Jervis, who was the licensing guy, he knew Nick in another incarnation, and that's what brought it together. I think maybe Terry had gone to. I don't know the circumstances. It's like yourself. I never got to see the contracts on certain things to find out how they actually came about. But Terry was very inventive. He was the guy who brought Thunderbirds back to the BBC in the 90s, convinced them that Thunderbirds would be a success. And the BBC thought, gave it a go to fill a slot. And as you know, it was huge, with the Blue Peter Island that was appeared in all the newspapers and things like that. It was just like reviving these puppets all over again. That they've been such.
Thunderbirds was a very creative and influential piece of fiction, because there was a sort of on-off relationship between us and the Gerry Anderson thing, and Kevin knew Anderson quite well. The Just Imagine. Fanzine, I suppose you'd call it, for special effects technicians that we did.
Yeah.
And we often used to end up hauling out some of the film studios. I used to go and write for it. And we interviewed Anderson at Pinewood.
When
Superman 1 was being made. we both went into the Fortress of Solitude. Was that the big white thing?
Yeah.
There we go. We sort of had a sit around and talk on a fag and talk inside the set. You know, it's on the Bond set, wasn't it?
And yeah. Derek Meddings, I think, work on that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. We met him there, and he hadn't gone for, especially as a modeler. Every one was done. I mean, he once saw that model. He's the quite short. Right, he had, he went to bed now, died a few years back, but inside his office, which was overlooked by a 1/10 scale of the Golden Gate Bridge that they used for Superman thing.
Yeah.
He had like 40 different bottles of dust, different types of dust for different models, you know.
Yeah.
And he said that was the key with Thunderbird 2. That was the big brown one, wasn't it? The green one.
The big green one,
Keeping it dirty. Make it all clean and nobody will believe it. But they put scrapes on the side and everything. He was a very, very nice man, but absolutely super.
Yeah, and of course, Robusters had a little bit of Thunderbirds thrown into it, didn't it?
It just went round and round in circles, you see, because at one time when we met Anderson, we had used Thunderbirds as a sort of inspiration for Robusters, and there are certain elements of Thunderbirds went into Robusters. But then he was making the orbital one with the robots. I can never remember the name of it. Anderson was making this other
TV. Terrahawks.
Yeah, Terrahawks. And they looked at our Robusters to get ideas from it. all of the studios used to have, particularly Hitchhiker's Guide Studio, different thing, I know, but they would have our Center Space set up on their walls to get ideas. And this happened, and say, you know, we took something from them to make something, and then Anderson would look at the something we made and think, oh, I'll do something like that. It just was a really nice round circle, all benefiting from one another.
That's definitely going to be another appendix to this episode, I think.
Well, I can tell you more jokes about that if you want. But
yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Kev used to do a lot of stuff, almost wrecked one of the set scenes when he walked in while they were shooting something on Thunderbirds and tripped over a wire and put all the lights out. But the lovely story that Anderson told us was there's a Thunderbirds where they use giant crocodiles, which were really crocodiles about this long, right? And they wanted them to jump, to leap out of the water, filmed in slow-mo, obviously. So they started off with sticks pointing them and shoving them, this wouldn't work. They used bigger sticks and shouted at them, and they still wouldn't jump. So then Anderson, or one of them, I don't know, he's not whoever said, was electricity in. So they wired these crocs up, these little crocs, with like 20 volts DC, and they still wouldn't go. And then by this time, somebody phoned the RSPCA, and the RSPCA inspector came down and said, what are you doing here? I said, well, and Anderson actually spoke to the guys, said, look, we'll hold our hands up, we're trying to make them jump, we're putting 20 volts DC. And the guy said, oh, you need at least 120. The RSPCA man helped wire up these crocs, 120 volts. Ooh. Away they went.
That's on a par with some of the Skippy Kangaroo stories that I've been told, which I'm not allowed to repeat, but they have suffice to say that the thing about no animals were harmed is not entirely true.
When
it comes to that show.
Again, we heard through one of Gary Anderson's contacts, but there's one of the BBC special effects now, Gecko now. But there's a film called That Darned Cat. Yeah, it's where the opening shot has a cat jumping. So it's an upshot, straight up, and the cat flies across like that. And they tried everything to make this cat do it. It's a longer story, but it was borrowed from someone. There wasn't the star cat, it was one that just happened to look like the star. Films and animals do not get on. It wouldn't do it until in the end, the special effects technician turned over and said, roll camera now, right, shoot up. He's just got a cat in his hand and swooped. And it went across. It was a beautiful shot because the cat went wow, straight across. It's in the titles of the film. Cat never seen again.
It's an amazing sequence in itself, never mind the throwing of the cat. How they actually got a cat to do anything like that, and especially when I can tell you that one I've got.
The addendum to that is that they borrowed it off somebody's landlady that they were staying with, and it just went. It never came back. Luckily, there's some pictures of it, so they went out and bought another one from a rescue, dyed it to make it look the same. I said, "Did that miss?" And then just went over to it. Terrible. Films and animals don't get on. However, going back.
Going back to what we were talking about. Harry Harrison, I'm reading from the Lambiac website here. After serving in the US Armed Forces, he took art classes from Bern Hogarth. He teamed up with fellow student Wallace Wood, and together they began producing art for Fox, Quality and Fawcett before joining EC in 1948. The pair were mostly illustrating stories from weird fantasy and weird science. Harrison eventually broke with Wood and continued to work with Jules Pfeiffer and Warren Broderick at Fawcett for a while, but left the field to focus on writing and editing.
Is that Wallace, as in Wally Wood, the director? Who did all the most amazingly awful squash tomato films. There's a film called Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, I think, by a director called Wally Wood.
No, it's Wally Wood, the artist.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
There is a director called Wally Wood as well, that did a lot of really appalling sci-fi films. But yeah, okay. Now, I'm not at all surprised, because that's the sort of thing that Harry would do. I just didn't know. I say, like most of us, we assume that he was a words man, and he did really great novels and scripts and things like that. And that story he did, the Lost Patrol, I think. It's a fantastic read. It was one of the Embletons drew it as well, whether it was Jerry or the other one, I'm not sure. Ron or Jerry. I think it might have been Ron. And it's a fantastic story. Elements of Technicolor Time Machine in it as well. So it's a World War II, not a tank landing craft, the other one, an infantry landing craft that gets lost in time and keeps washing up in different conflict situations.
Originally written by Willie Patterson, who of course is better known for working with Sid Jordan on Jeff Hawke.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that, he kicked him off. It's one of his early works.
Well, I'm pretty sure Harry did some of it, though, didn't he?
Yeah, no, I've no doubt of it. It's like Michael Moorcock working on all the, on stuff as well. Elric's another strong character that was probably more fantasy oriented.
There's a lot of the similar character traits that Jim's got, but in Elric, but the humour isn't there. Different levels of more sort of restrained wit than outright occasional farce that Jim can get into.
Yeah,
it's really noticeable that in the late 60s and into the 70s, you do get a lot of these rebel characters, the individuals who don't play by the rules, and that goes through all the way to the vigilante cop films like Dirty Harry and things like that.
It was almost a we might, if you're going to do a cop, he's got to be a vigilante cop. Or if you're going to do a psychiatrist, he's got to be a vigilante psychiatrist, as in Hugh Laurie. Not Chase, that's a different story, wouldn't it?
House.
It might as well have been Holmes, come on.
Yes, well, he was. That's what he was intended to be, and it became.
But it almost became you've got to do a vigilante with your character. Otherwise, they don't think it will work, Strange.
I mean, what are the specific qualities of Jim DeGries that just appeal to you? Is it that he's, that rule breaker or you can kind of fight and talk his way out of any situation?
There is that, but he always finds a way, a devious, clever, ingenious way to get out of the most appalling situations that you think, he's just been thrown off a cliff and it's in the vacuum and his face mask has come off. end of chapter. You know, in the next one, it won't be with a bound he was free, which it has happened on occasions, but he'll get out of it somehow. And it was his wit and humour and just general all-round optimistic way of looking at crazy life he lived in.
And I wanted to just talk about Carlos a little bit more. Obviously, he's no longer with us, sadly. Thinking back to the work he was putting in on Stainless Steel, right? As we said, you know, it's a bit of a labour of love. Were you surprised by how much he put into those pages? Because they just seem so tight and strong. You know, the design element, particularly on the sci-fi bits, you know, the robots and the spaceships, it's just, I mean, it's fantastic stuff. Were you ever surprised by just how inventive he was being?
No. Well, yes and no, because he always did that. No matter what he was doing, it was always 120% better than he thought it was going to be. And he'd find some new angle, some new twist on spaceship design or clothing or whatever. And I suppose you can get blasé about it, because Carlos was always going to be, as I said, 120% better than you thought he possibly could be. And he's a great loss. I mean, I think he did more for the British picture strip than any of the other artists who we've used. And some of them have been really, really great, but Carlos, like Jim, broke the rules and got a result. I mean, changed the face of British comics, I really do believe that.
Yeah, there's a, you know, that individual unique style that he brings to the strip. It's a perfect match. And the fact that he loved the character is evident throughout. I mean, I remember him, I was at Raptus convention in Norway back in 2003, and he was one of the guests. And he, at that point, he was trying to get a graphic novel off the ground in Europe and was being told, knocked back by French publishers who told him his work wasn't detailed enough. Myself and Mike Collins and others who are around the table, Pat Mills is there. I'm not sure if Pat was at that point, but we were just astonished by this remark that his work wasn't considered detailed enough to qualify to be published by a French publisher. It just made no sense whatsoever to us.
These were publishing executives, I tell you. They weren't actually
right. Yeah, management. Yeah, probably.
Oh,
yeah.
There you are. Well, that's another reason I got out of writing fiction and that side of publishing. I just couldn't stand the publishers. Rebellion, I have to say, are much, much better. But publishers were always out to screw you one way or another. And that's why I went off freelance in different directions. You know, publishers still screw you up. But I can believe that, because they are publishing executives. They aren't. How can you say that about Carlos's work? It's just ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean, you didn't need the detail there. One of the beauties of Carlos's work is you look at it and you can almost hear them speaking. It makes the character live for you. And he certainly did that with the rat, because the rat occasionally would speak to camera, which was something that I did very early on. Although the books are told in first person, aren't they? Yeah, I'm sure they are. Occasionally, Jim would speak to the reader, which a first person narration does. But if it was done in film, he wouldn't. But I remember the first one I put it in, where Jim has been cornered by some coppers, and he turns to the reader and says, "You never take me alive, copper." And he turns to the reader and says, "I always wanted to say that line." And that was something that I put in. That wasn't Harry's thing. And I said, "Well, I'm sorry, Harry, I did that because I thought that it was right for this medium. And that's the sort of thing Jim would say." And after that, he said, "Great, yeah, I don't need to see your scripts anymore to pass them." Because that is exactly what he wanted. And he just thought it was great. But again, you know, it's Carlos's work, you can almost hear the character speaking.
Yeah, that goes back to what I was saying about the fact that you, when you got the, you know, having written the script, once you got the pages back, you've got that opportunity to rework the dialogue because you don't need some of the dialogue because Carlos is using the visual to tell the story. Mm. Always fantastic in that regard.
Yeah. I think Carlos, along with probably Harry, would have made quite good film directors. I always thought it's what I wanted to do as well, but it's just impossible. You couldn't. When you're writing a strip, we've all got our own ways of doing a strip, but mine, which is why it was so great doing The Sound of Steel Rap, was because Harry had a very visual mind. It was almost, I remember the first story I wrote was a thing called The Suicide Club for Pat Mills on Action, and he wanted an airplane story, and I decided to do something about a British fighter running out of ideas about how to use the airplane, and I knew that the answer was to fly like a fighter, not like a bomber. That's beside the point. I went over and over all the ideas until I thought, and I couldn't get anywhere. So I thought, okay, if I was making a film about it, what would I do? And I thought, bang, it just came straight away. Opening shot, close up of the aircraft, banked about 45 degrees, trailing smoke, wallet cut round. You put a camera in the back of your head when you're working out what the scenes are going to be. I always did that, and I've still got a visual mind. I do artwork of my own as well, just for fun. Harry, as I now know, was a professional artist. And that was my way of doing a story. I think like you're making a film. And although Carlos is not working with moving images, I'm sure he thought the same way. If this was a film, how would I do it? What shots would I use? And Harry, obviously, as I said, same thing. And it was like three frustrated film directors all fighting with one another to get it right.
But it worked.
And it's lovely to hear it.
I want to just pick up on something you mentioned a moment ago about the your disillusionment with working in fiction. And I wanted to find out if you had any recollections of... considering that you had been editorial previously, what your relationship was like with the editorial teams you took over after you on 2000 AD when you were working on Stainless Steel Rat?
Well, the answer to that is Mr. McManus. Steve was my contact. I had very little contact, if at all, with the editorial teams there. If I wanted to do something for 2000, I'd get in touch with Steve and say, you know, I want to do this, is it what you have in mind? And he'd either say yes or no, and I'd do it. But I didn't have, like, big-time contact with anyone there.
No, it's interesting that, you know, you did three series of this. You know, as far as I'm aware, it was popular at the time. But it's so fascinating that, you know, it happened and then it's never really been replicated again. And like I said, 2008, they've done the odd little adaptation here and there, but not to any great degree of success. It seems to be, I don't know, what's the quality about this that ensured that it worked where others haven't, do you think?
I think actually what we were discussing earlier, the character of Jim DeGries and his worlds and time and everything is just perfect for picture strip. It's terribly, terribly visual. The wit and the humour make it much more enjoyable than a straightforward bang-bang shoot-em-up Star Wars type thing. The character was just right. I'd have to say, with the exception of some other Harry Harrison books, I really can't think of any standard characters in the world of big-time science fiction which would actually work. I mean, if you look at Asimov and the Foundation series, that's quite aside from being an N-volume work. I think there's about seven or eight of them. The main character running through it... would not stand up a story. The only one that might was the robot, whose name escapes me.
From Cage of Steel. The Robot Detective. Yeah, well, they've done it. They did try, didn't they? Was it with Will Smith off the top of my head?
Yeah, no, the...
Didn't work.
What was the robot's name? Because he's in virtually everything that Asimov wrote. He was in Cage of Steel, which was the first one, the robot story. Yeah? It was a cop, robot cop. Daniel J. something or other. Daniel J. Daniel, the robot. He would work. But not in the way that, in the perfect use of the stories that Asimov made of him, which was a zinc to run through about three different series of stories. And he's the only thing left alive, effectively, at the end of the Foundation series, even though he started, God knows how many years before, as a little side character in a robot cop story. But Asimov wove him in. And he's a great character. It wouldn't work as a picture strip in the form that Asimov wrote him. You'd have to rewrite it. That's the thing about Slippery Jim. He works as a picture strip the way Harrison wrote him.
R. Daniel Olivaux?
That's it, yep.
There we go.
R. the robot, Daniel Olivaux. And he started as a little side character in the first story, which had nothing to do with the Foundation series, but then he gets brought into it towards the end. As I think Asimov realised that he had a good character there and decided to use him in an unusual way.
One last question. With the adaptations as you were going along, was there ever a temptation to do your own thing? Was there ever a point where you thought, actually, I know this is an adaptation, but I've got a better idea for how to progress this or end this or introduce another character? Or was everything there that actually, you know, that didn't come to mind?
No, that never came into it. If I had that idea, I was doing the stories as Harrison wrote them. I didn't want to rewrite them. I occasionally had to leave stuff out or take in a little something else to get over the fact of dropping about three chapters. But in answer to your primary question, no, because that wasn't what I was doing. And it just wouldn't have been right. You know, I'm there to do the Harry Harrison story, and it works perfectly. If it had been Daniel Olivaux, the robot character from Asimov, then he would have to do something differently because he didn't fit the picture strip. But Jim DeGree's picture strip, so let's do it like that.
John, is there anything else you wanted to touch on or ask?
No, I don't think so. I think we've covered a heck of a lot of ground. I mean, it's just a testament to the strip that we're discussing it so many years on, because and the success of the collection is fantastic to hear. I can't say I'm surprised, because as I said earlier in the interview, it's one of those. It's a strong character, and again, 2080's strength has always been strong characters. You know, from Judge Dredd, Stainless Steel Rat, and he just fitted right in with the comic as it was then. And you would go on to have, you know, for example, Robo Hunter, which is possibly the character that's most like Slippery Jim DeGrees. Continuing later on, so you know it's always been the strength of 2080, and it's great that it was part of it. It's just a shame, though. I mean, I know I appreciate what you're saying, that it's difficult to find other science fiction novels to adapt, but I think it is a bit of a shame that there hasn't been more attempts to do that. But we're lucky to have what we have.
Well, yeah, I think just come back to what Kelvin was saying, that with a lot of the classic sci-fi, it's high concept, you know. Yeah. The idea is the primary character, and the actual characters carry that with them. Whereas this, and you know, a few select others, the character comes first. You know.
Yeah, I mean, for example, there's no reason why you couldn't do E. Doc Smith's Lensman characters, but you'd have to completely again. You'd have to go back to reworking them for the audience of the day, you know, because they were written at a time, you know, they were banged out in the 1950s for one centre word, and the characters, you know, even when Stainless Steel Rat was appearing in 2000 AD, the world had moved on and culture had changed. And it, but the great thing about Stainless Steel Rat was it's perfect for that particular time.
Yeah. Well, as I said earlier, talking about like classic sci-fi, I'd love to have seen City and Stars done, because it's that's a mind-affecting novel. It really makes you think. It drags you out and think, you know, is this what mankind is meant for? It's also a very exciting story as well. But if you look at more recent work, you know, the much lamented E.M. Banks and his culture novels, I mean, they would, I guess they probably could be made into films. But so much of it is intellectual thought stuff. There's not a great deal of action. He has great characters, brilliant characters. How can you not love a robot missile thing, which is really a sort of minder who's looking after one of the characters? It's a little box about this wide, that tall, which follows its mistress, who it calls Toots, all the way around. Its idea of fun is to go bird watching in the evening. How can you not love a character like that? But visually, it's not going to work.
I think with Banksy stuff, it's more the influence it's had on other characters and stories. You know, there's so many writers now who owe this huge and you know, acknowledged by everybody, debt to Ian M. Banks for the influence he's had on them. So it's kind of His novels live vicariously through other forms of media.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, I wish I could find them, because no one's writing anything as imaginative, as entertaining, and like the rat, so full of wit and humour, as well as mind-bending ideas. I mean, there's one of his things. I don't think there are any humans in it at all. It's all the big AI. It's the big spaceship going around with brains the size of several planets, each of them. Having a sort of a soap opera type war with one another. Mm. I mean, that sounds extremely odd, eccentric, dull, and boring, but it's so exciting. And you think, what is this thing the size of the moon going to do next? You know, it's like, anyone seen XR3i? Yeah, he's just gone down the path. It's like something from EastEnders, but extremely enjoyable, but not makeable as a strip or as a film, I think. I think they could be. I mean, what was it? The Tarkovsky thing, the spaceship one.
Solaris.
Yeah. Hmm. You wouldn't think that could be made into a film. A lot of people said it wasn't very good. But I think the Russian version. I didn't like the recent one. The Russian version is brilliant. It's a very different film. Not very much happens, but the thoughts and feelings of the people and the actual pictures work very, very well. Mm. They're not a whiz along at twice the speed of sound, bang, bang, shoot 'em up story, but they tell you lovely stories. But it can work, but not to make a lot of money, I think, which is why it ain't gonna happen.
It will be interesting to see what Apple have done with Foundation when it comes out at the end of this year.
Are they doing it?
Apple TV, he'll be on Apple TV in this. I think it begins this week, I think. On that,
they'll still be going at the turn of the century, I think. There's so much of it. Eight or nine,
is it? Well, I don't know. I think the first three books are the ones that I've read. They were the core Asimov books, and everything else is sort of like, you know, raking over the coals in some ways. It's a bit like, it's a bit like the Arthur C. Clarke story, where the names escape me, where the spaceship turns up, in Earth orbit, and they go and investigate it, and then
that goes on forever. And it's isn't there four or five in that? One of them starts off with about the first quarter of it. It's all about this woman being pregnant and the pains and sensations of that, and you think, okay, fine, I could get this from a textbook. But going back to Asimov, though, the last book in the Foundation series is worth a read. I think Daniel Oliver pops up in that, and it's very, very good. worth a go.
Okay, well, maybe I'll go back and have a look at them. So I remember reading the Panther book versions of the first three Foundations, along with Corridors of Time and all those those early Panther books my dad bought first, and I would read them after him. So
you read The End of Eternity?
Yeah, The End of Eternity, and a lot of early James Blish stuff as well. So, but yeah, you're right, you know, all that sort of high concept stuff just doesn't work as a comic strip.
Yeah, End of Eternity
it
worked as a comic strip. You have to change the characters slightly. Again, it's not made perfectly for picture strip, but it could be made to work in picture strip. And it's a bit like, I remember on Action, we had a story called Coffin Sub about a submarine. It just wouldn't work because it was set in such an enclosed environment all the time, inside the submarine, boring. Inside the corridors of time travel is where most of the action takes place in End of Eternity. And you'd have to put it out of that to make it worth reading. But
yeah,
it's a very good story, a marvelous story, well worth it. Anyway, I'm sure we've run over by a very great deal, Mike.
I'm so glad. I'm just looking forward to editing this one.
Yeah, you're going to have fun with this one.
But it's great. I've got a meeting in like 5 minutes, so thank you, gents. I really appreciate that.
Most enjoyable. Thank you very good. Much.
Thank you very much.
I will be in touch about Andir and the details of the end of show bloopers reel for Blade 7. Which I say cannot be repeated on it.
Well, thank you so much to John and to Kelvin for a nice little chat about the Stainless Steel Rat. We're going to be back in 2 weeks, so I promise. So make sure you tune in for that. Don't forget, if you've not subscribed to the 2000 AD newsletter, then you are missing out. Go along to 2080.com/newsletter. Also, the Treasury of British Comics, which is our imprint based on the IPC archive. So all the stablemates of 2000 AD and 100 years of comic book publishing. That has its own email bulletin that goes out every month now. So go along to treasuryofbritishcomics.com/newsletter to have a look at that. So as I said, we'll see you in a fortnight, Earthlets. Definitely promise that we'll be here. So until then, Splendid Earthrig.
Alert, alert, alert. Full power levels dangerously high. Alert, alert. Be 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.